Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Lord Onyx, and all the hosts 7 nights a week for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics right here on Blog Talk Radio.
LCO1BTR with your host Onyx. This show is a production of Lady of the Circle and the Oaks, a Corellian proto temple in Thomasville, North Carolina. After the show, we invite you to click over to ladyofthecircle.org to learn more about us. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. And good evening, everybody. It is April 25th, Saturday. It is 10 o'clock at night in Eastern Time here in North Carolina. So that means you're at Blog Talk Radio, listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. This is LCO1BTR, and I am Onyx. I want to thank you and you and you and all of you out there, whether you're listening live or in the archives, for joining me tonight, because I understand that you had a choice and you chose to spend your time with me, and I thank you. I want to I'm under a little bit of a different technology tonight, so I'd like to ask those in the chat room if the sounds is okay at this point so that I can adjust it if necessary. Can I get a sound check in the chat room? Anybody in there would be okay. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, thank you very much for giving me the sound check. And let's move on tonight. Well, there's a couple of things I want to mention before I launch into the show tonight. The first of which, I still want to remind people of the Morning Glory Zell Memorial Foundation drive. You can check out that activity or that drive by going to www.mgzmfoundation.org. I believe that's a .org. It's not, it's a .com, and I apologize for that. I had a little bit of a brain slip there. But it's a Morning Glory Zell Memorial Foundation. And Oberon and the crew out there are trying to put together the finances to buy Buzzard Gulch, which is kind of a what Oberon calls an old dude ranch type thing. So I'm going to try to put a village in out there. So I think everybody needs to go over there and look at it. There's a GoFundMe campaign attached. And if you can't throw a couple of dollars at them, I've just got confirmation. It is .org. Thank you in the chat room very much. So mgzmfoundation.org. If you can't throw a dollar or two or 100 or so at them for this wonderful drive, then at least do a little bit. And the very minimum that I would like for you to do, that I challenge you to do, is to share that link and that GoFundMe campaign everywhere, because we can make this happen as a community. So get out there and do what you can. And do more than you can. Do everything you can. And I thank you for that. Next Wednesday night, which will be the 29th of April, I'm going to have a man on with me by the name of John Springer. Now, people who know John know that he's very active in the community. He's very interested in fairies and the wilderness, the woods, and living, and how we interact with it, and how we interact with the fairies. And he's coming on next Wednesday to talk about some of the things that he's involved with, including the Fairy and Earth Festival that's coming up in May. So, dynamic man, please join me for that. That's next Wednesday, April 29th at 10 p.m. So that's going to be an exciting show. I want to let everybody know that I have a new Facebook page that I am using to let everybody know where I am and what where you can find all my media. When I say media, I mean everything from a WordPress account to CNN iReport to YouTube channel to anything that I do on the internet radio. And just anything media dealing with me or coming from me. And that's going to be facebook.com/ravensmedia. And that's Raven's Nest Media. But the URL is actually facebook.com/ravensmedia. So go over, check that page out. Give it a like so that you can, you know, get things across your feed. Of where what I'm doing and where I'm doing it and when I'm doing it. And, of course, I want everyone to go over and check out the website for Lady of the Circle, Lady of the Circle in the Oaks, LCO we call it. I know we shorten it down to LCO. And you can find out everything about LCO by going over to www.ladyofthecircle.org. And from there, you can find out about the Proto Temple. It's Corellian Proto Temple. It's located in Thomasville, North Carolina. If you are within the area or within broom flying distance, I'd like to remind you that we have, we present public rituals for each of the 8 Sabbaths. Plus, we do a pagan potluck picnic each year. We are in the Winston-Salem, Thomasville, Greensboro area of North Carolina. The Proto Temple is currently located in Thomasville, North Carolina, but we are only a stone's throw south of Winston-Salem in Forsyth County. So anybody in this area, come on out. There's an events page on the ladyofthecircle.org. Just click over to events on a little tab, a little button, and you'll see when our public events are. And there's even a map there, linked through MapQuest to be able to tell you how to get to where we're going to be. So there's contact information and all there for the temple and or for the Proto Temple and for me. So tonight we're going to talk about the science of happiness. And you may ask me, is there actually a science of happiness? Well, yes, there is, or else I wouldn't be doing this episode. So we're going to discuss something called the Tetris effect. We're going to examine what it is and how it shapes the way we see the world. We're also going to try to answer the question of, are we set up to naturally be sympathetic to our fellow humans? We're going to take a fascinating journey through the science of happiness, and we're going to discuss the difference between being happy and unhappy. We're going to talk about the key to implementing new habits. We're going to explore the principle of activation energy and much, much more. Again, I want to thank you for joining me on this magical journey. And many of us, a lot of us already understand that the way we look at life and its events can have a major impact on how we feel about them. Now, me being pagan, and I'm also interested in astrology, I'm fascinated by the concept of Mercury retrograde. For those of you who do not know what Mercury retrograde is, let me explain a little bit without getting too heavily into planetary mechanics. At certain times of the year, because of the orbital paths of Earth and Mercury, this planet, Mercury, appears to be moving backwards along its orbital path from our observational point here on Earth. Since the planet Mercury is associated with communication, many people will tell you that anything dealing with communication will be messed up during this time. During Mercury retrograde, if you're on social media, you're going to see it plastered all over the place, how Mercury retrograde has negatively affected people, how it's really screwed up communication, how it's really screwed up this, how it's really screwed up that, and there's begs and pleas, hoping that it'll be over soon. So for many people, Mercury retrograde is approached with nothing less than anxiety and apprehension. Because communication is integral in our relationships, whether they're personal or professional. Because of this, it can be a huge source of stress for some people. Now, I want you to consider for a moment that instead of looking at Mercury retrograde as a time when everything involving communication goes awry, that we accept that during this time, clear communication may be a bit more challenging. Maybe we can look at Mercury retrograde as being a time for us to develop and sharpen our skills in that arena of communication. During Mercury retrograde, we can pay particular attention to how we send a message and how it's received. And we can remember that it's not enough to think that we have communicated a concept clearly. We have to realize that in order for the communication to be successful, the receiver has to interpret the message the way it was intended by the person, by the transmitter, by you. Now, there are plenty of ways to make sure this is happening. This is the time we can look at those. Mercury retrograde is not a curse. It's a blessing. Because during this time, we have an excellent opportunity to dissect and look closely at our communication skills. And when we find an issue or a challenge in our communication skill set, we can then work to overcome the challenge and become a more effective communicator. And then we realize that nothing about Mercury retrograde or the situations in our lives have changed. We've moved from seeing Mercury retrograde in a negative light to seeing it in a positive light. All of a sudden, once we accept that paradigm shift, all the stress of Mercury retrograde just falls away. This is just one example of how the way we look at things and events shape the way we feel about them. So, what is this science of happiness? Before we go down that rabbit hole, Let me explain a little bit about the science of statistics, because it plays in here. One of the first things that's taught to students of statistics or the economy and even psychology is how to clean up your data in order to make it so that you do not have positive and negative outliers messing up a very clear trend that normally occurs. So what happens then in science is that we create something that may be called the cult of the average. When we look at and analyze the world, if I ask a simple question like, how fast can a child learn to read in a classroom? Science then changes that to, how fast does the average student learn to read in the classroom, deleting the people who read slower or faster? And then the average becomes the norm. And if you fall below the norm, psychologists get all excited because it means that maybe you have a depression or a disorder or maybe both. And then they get to study you and try as hard as they can to find some way of moving you back up to being normal again. The entire goal of most psychologists is to return you back to normal. But think about it. If we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average. We need to study the positive outliers, those that are way above the average, and learn from them. People that are above the curve for anything, whether it's energy, happiness, resilience, intelligence, or musical talent, or whatever, whatever it is that causes these people to be so successful, we need to study them. We need to not only just raise people back up to average, but to raise the entire average by gleaning ideas from these people that are way above the average curve, way above the curve. The science of happiness. Part of the reason I think that this is so important is because we're surrounded by a world which is consciously affecting us. Consider that for every one article there is, scientific article, research article, that there is about how it's possible to raise your level of potential back up to average, or about the raise your potential, your level of potential, you know, from wherever it is, from above average even up. For every one article there is about how it's possible to raise that potential, there are 17 articles about depression and disorders. So this means that we know a whole lot about how to be sick and how to underperform, but we know very little about how to thrive and to raise our level of potential. And this affects all of us. Remember that ratio, 1 to 17, because it'll come up again later. It's not the reality that shapes us. It's the lens through which we view the reality that shapes our experience of it. Even our bodies and immune systems respond to the lens through which we view the world around us. Now, I want you to try something for me. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do will only work if there is more than one of you sitting there together listening to the show. If you don't have a partner with you right now, try this the next time you're around somebody. If there are two or more of you in an even number, choose which ones will be number ones and which ones will be number twos. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to take all the self-discipline and control that you've learned throughout your life, whether it's through education, meditation, whatever, all those skills of self-discipline and control. And I want you to put it to use for 7 seconds in this exercise. Person number one, I want you to not get angry with person two when they do to you what I'm about to ask them to do. Don't get angry. Don't get sad. And please don't cry. Don't laugh. Don't smile. And don't show frustration. I want you to do nothing, which should be pretty easy for 7 seconds. I want you to go completely neutral on the inside. Show no emotions on your face. None. No frustration, anger, sadness, happiness, or smiling or laughter for the 7 seconds. When person number one is ready, then person number two, please look at them. Make sure you're looking at them in the eye. Make that eye contact. And then I want you to smile at them genuinely. Genuinely, and hold that smile and that eye contact for 7 seconds. Ready? Go. Okay, now I want you to switch roles. The person was two, be one, one, be two. Make sure you are looking in each other's eyes. Make that eye contact. The person who was the smiler before will now show no emotions on their face. Same thing. Go emotionally neutral. Go completely neutral. Now, the other person, while looking in their eyes, again, smile genuinely for 7 seconds. Go. It should be very easy to control your face for 7 seconds. When this experiment is performed in groups so that we can see a broad swatch of what's going on, usually about 80% of the participants cannot control their face for only 7 seconds. And will involuntarily smile back. This experiment has been conducted in groups around the world, in many different cultures, in many different age categories. And the results are always about the same, right around the 80% mark. This indicates very well that smiles are contagious. Now, a smile is not like something, you know, like the swine flu or anything like that, which actually has a physical contagion that scientists can study. We've never discovered a physical contagion that causes the smile to spread so quickly to the other person. So what's going on? What's going on? Well, researchers have tried to figure that out. And they've discovered something even more powerful. A few years ago, we discovered something in the human brain that has been called the mirror neuron. Mirror, as in looking, reflecting back, and neuron, as in, you know, those firing things in the brain, right? The mirror neuron are parts of your brain that light up when you see something within your visual field. So let me explain. For example, if I'm sitting in a brain scan machine and I smile, part of my brain will light up as if to say, Onyx, you're smiling. Now, there's another part of the brain where if you smile at me, but I'm not smiling while still sitting in that brain scan, suddenly a part of my brain lights up and says, Onyx, you're smiling. These are mirror neurons. You are in my visual field. And they light up when they see something in their visual field, experiencing something. When that occurs, before I can stop myself and say, I'm not smiling, part of my brain drops something called dopamine into the brain, which elevates and raises your level of mood and happiness. These mirror neurons are right next to your motor cortex, right next to them, right next to it. So your brain starts to contort into a smile before you can say, I'm not smiling. This is the same reason why yawns are contagious. Same mechanism. So if you compare those exact same mechanism, you're sitting in a room and somebody yawns, and then you yawn, you can't control yourself. And then everybody's in the room yawning, and it's going back and forth. The same mechanism in the brain is in play when you see somebody smile. In another experiment, there were 15 participants standing on a subway platform waiting for a train. The researchers introduced somebody called a research confederate. And if you don't know what that is, that's someone who works on the research team that the participants are unaware of, that this person is actually a researcher. Okay, so you introduce somebody into the group that's working with the research team, but the participants don't know it. So that confederate comes and stands in the middle of the 15 participants. And then they start to bounce nervously in one place and to tap their foot impatiently and look at their watch repeatedly. Within just 2 minutes of standing there at the subway platform, in all the different places that this experiment was done, all the different slices of culture that this experiment was done, there was an average of 7 to 12 of the 15 participants who started to bounce nervously in one place and or tap their foot impatiently. This is between 46% and 80%. The reason this is so significant is that we are hardwired for sympathy in our brain. We can understand when somebody is ecstatic, tired, or depressed. That's sympathy. But the discovery of mirror neurons that activate when something is going on in our visual field indicates that we are hardwired not just for sympathy, but also for empathy, which is amazing. It means that when someone else is experiencing something, we are more likely to experience that ourselves. Both the stress of standing on the platform or the positivity around us. A world in which the media is so skewed in a negative direction, in a world that is dealing with a crisis where our news is about the same ratio as an academic research of negative to positive. Remember that 1 to 17 that I told you would come back up? Our news broadcasts. For every one positive, there's only an average of 17 negative stories. In that world, we have to find a way to buffer our brains against the negative effects of the people around us so that we can create a new one-way street of our positivity activating these mirror neurons. And that's what we're talking about. I'm going to take a little break here. Let you chew on that for a few minutes. We'll play a song. Do a little station business. And then I'll come back. And we'll finish this out. I'm going to play a song by an artist that really doesn't get a whole lot of airplay here. But I think that, you know, we need to give equal, a little bit of extra push to those that are not getting the airtime that they normally would, or that they should, I guess I should say. This artist, her name is Castalia Alexandrian. And the song I'm going to play is called Open to the Elements.
There is one power in the universe, and I am a perfect manifestation of that power. And as such, I pray for peace. I pray for love. I pray for stability. I pray for the nation where I live. I pray for the world. By my will, so mote it be. And it is so. You are listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, where we believe that all manifestations of the divine are valid. You had a choice, and you chose to spend time with us. Join us nightly at 10 p.m. Eastern Time for a wide variety of programming. If you miss one of our shows, there are plenty of places to catch up. Every show is archived at www.blogtalkradio.com/CERN. Look for the on-demand shows. They are available as a free podcast download on iTunes and now available free on the TuneIn Radio application and website. Follow us on Twitter at SURN_ORG and on Facebook. Each of our shows has a Facebook presence so that you can keep abreast with what is going on. If you have any moans, groans, gripes, bitches, complaints, or compliments, you may send those to the station management by emailing surn.org@gmail.com. On Thursday nights, Onyx and Terry discuss questions that have been sent in by you, the listeners. If you have a question you want them to discuss, please send it to the station's email address. If you'd like credit for the question, please let us know in the email. For more information about our network, please click over to www.spiritualunityradionetwork.org. Your support is greatly appreciated, and we humbly thank you for that.
You're listening to LCO on BTR on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We're glad you're here. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I am Onyx. You were listening to LCO on BTR tonight. We're talking about the science of happiness. Now, driving on with the topic, in the business world, it's been found that if you just try to maximize somebody's potential without caring about their well-being or their happiness, sometimes you break them. There's a correlation between how happy a person is at work and how optimistic they are and how successful they are. Another thing that's been found in those levels of business where the competition to get into it is high. You know, there's top level performing jobs, the executive positions, everything. Is that those with high potential will get in. But when they get there, some of them become depressed and they underperform their obvious potential. A lot of people don't understand why someone who is in a business position that carries with it privilege and a huge paycheck can be so unhappy. Of course, you're happy when you get the job, but once you're in that environment, you become desensitized. It's been found that if I can control your environment or understand your environment, I can only predict 10% of the difference between the employee and the individual's happiness. This means that 90% is not due to our external world, but rather the lens through which we view it based on our experiences and our genes. Now, we're talking about that group, you know, that group of top performing executives. Many people will say, what does this group have to be unhappy about? Well, the reason they ask that question is because we have this belief that the external world is much more predictive than it actually is. In a large study that was conducted at Harvard University and repeated in many Fortune 500 companies around the world, many of the same questions and answers were found. So let me go back and explain what was found in the original Harvard study. And then the same type of things were found in these high-performing business environments. So imagine a student who, ever since they were 1 year old, was placed in the crib wearing a onesie that said, "Bound for Harvard." And ever since they were 1 year old and they grew, they were placed in special pre-K school that they had got enrolled in 4 years before being conceived. They were the top 1% of their class. Junior and senior high also, the top 1%. They take the standardized test to get into college. Again, top 1%. Boom, they're accepted to Harvard, Ivy League school. They walk into the freshman dining hall at Harvard, in through the front door, and they have a terrible realization. Because now, 50% of them are below average. What happens next is the interesting part. Because this is not the story of a privileged Ivy League student. It's the story of everyone living in the times that we are. When we are under threat and challenge by our environment, our mental construction, the way we conceive of the world, comes under threat as well. Or at least we perceive it to be. Now, for these students that we're talking about, their mental construction, which is the way they view their value and meaning as human beings, might have been wrapped up in getting good grades, always being the big fish in the pond. So now they're in an Ivy League school, and that's not the case anymore. When that changes, their world begins to crumble around them. Some people, in the midst of their mental construction being challenged, look around and say, "What are the things that cause me to feel that I'm strongest at? What are those things that cause me to feel inside and that I'm strongest at? What are the things I feel that have the most meaning to me?" And they invest all their time, energy, and resources into those things. They realize the people around them respond to their success, especially during challenges. So, in understanding that people around them respond, they invest in their social support networks that are around them. In that group, their stress levels decrease, depression rates decrease, and their performance rises higher than it was before the challenge. Other people in the same environment go in an opposite direction. They look at it and they say, "What are the things that are causing me the most stress? What are my weaknesses? I'm already good at those strengths. So I'm going to invest all my time, energy, and resources on those things, and I'm going to forget about the things I'm strongest at." So as a result, on a daily basis, they're faced with things that cause their self-esteem to dip. When that happens, they start to feel too busy. They're too busy at work or at school to eat lunch with other people. I have to eat in my office or at my desk or in the library or, you know, isolated. I need to sequester myself there because I am so focused. I need to hunker down and get my work done. As a result of this, they do the most unintelligent thing possible. They divest from the strongest predictor of their success during that time. Social support networks, your friends, family, peers, even more than your IQ or your education or your years of experience in a given field, the degree of social cohesion that you feel with other people is the greatest predictor of success during the times of challenge and stress. I'm going to toss a few disturbing statistics at you. Over the past decade, rates of depression have doubled. The mean onset, people that don't know what that means, the mean onset, the average age of being diagnosed with depression in 1979 was 29 years old. So those who got diagnosed with depression in 1979, the average age of those diagnosed with depression in 1979 was 29 years old. The mean onset of being diagnosed with depression, the average age of those who were diagnosed with depression in 2006 was 14 and a half years old. In 1979, the mean onset was 29 years old. In 2006, it was 14 and a half years old. We are experiencing a progress paradox where every metric of society is improving. Yet every metric of our well-being is in a steady retreat for the past two decades. Depression rates are up. Stress levels are up. We feel less connected to other people in our lives, and we feel less meaning in our lives. I know some of you are out there talking about, well, you know, the world isn't a worse place these days and we have more reason to be depressed. Let me throw this statistic at you. Economically speaking, okay, and then something else. Between 1972 and 2004, the average real buying power per American doubled. So the average American in 2004 had doubled the amount of buying power than the average American in 1972, doubled. But during that same period, our feelings of financial security, how we felt financially secure, our feelings of financial security dropped by 34%. And the number of respondents that said they felt happy with their lives dropped by 31%. That's what I'm talking about, a progress paradox. You would think that economically, all the metrics there, all the metrics in place financially, are telling us that between 1972 and 2004, our average buying power in the United States doubled. So we are twice as well off on the average in 2004 than we were in 1972. But our feeling of financial security dropped by 34%. And those that responded and said that they felt happy in their lives dropped by 31%. What can we do to stem that tide, to correct that paradox? What's been found is that your success is based largely on three things. Your ability to manage energy and stress in a positive way so that stress activates you. Number two, your social support network is strong and positive. And most importantly, number three, you have a belief that your behavior matters. 75% of your success is due to these three things. You notice in there I didn't say anything about education, experience, or anything like that, right? Because if 75% of your success is due to things like this, these three things, we're not focusing on the right things. As a society, the reason I believe we are experiencing the progress paradox is that we've been doing it the wrong way. We seem to think that if we work hard, we would be more successful. And if we were more successful, we would be happier. But what we're finding is that we're putting the cart before the horse. If we're positive while doing the task, we're more successful in the end. Happiness is a precursor to success, not the result. So how do we change that? How do we change what we're doing? Let's talk about it. Talk about a few of them, many of them. Let's talk about a few of them. The first is something I call, or that's called, the Tetris effect. Now, I'm sure a lot of you have played this game, or at least know how it's played. In an experiment, participants were paid to play Tetris for 5 hours straight, consecutively, nonstop. Okay? Afterwards, it was found that after playing Tetris for this extended period of time, participants started parsing the world into, how do I make straight lines? Because you remember, that's what you're doing in Tetris, is you're making straight lines. You're turning pieces and you're making straight lines out of them. Now, if you're playing Tetris, parsing the world in that manner is great, but it's maladaptive if you're not. This is called a Tetris effect. The same thing happens at the cognitive level. For instance, tax auditors who spend 8 to 14 hours a day fully engrossed in looking for errors may go home and continue to identify errors easily. But this makes them really good at their job, but really bad at personal relationships. They have become stuck in a negative Tetris effect. They get stuck in a pattern. So if we can get stuck in this negative pattern, we can get stuck in a pattern. And if we can get stuck in a pattern, can we get stuck in a positive pattern? Yes, absolutely, you can. If you do the same thing routinely for 21 days consecutively, you will create what is known as a life habit. This is something that you don't even think about doing, like putting on a seatbelt. If you put on a seatbelt 21 days consecutively every time you get in a vehicle, and then after that you get in a vehicle like a taxi maybe that doesn't have a seatbelt, you feel like something's missing. So, an experiment was conducted with gratitude. There was a researcher in 2003 and 2004 that had people for 21 days straight write down three things they were grateful for with as much specificity as possible. They couldn't put down, I'm happy for my health. They had to put down what about their health and why they're happy about it, okay? They did this three times a day at the same time of day for 21 days to see the effect on their positivity. People included in this experiment were some of them were extremely pessimistic. And others were extremely optimistic. They found that if you do this, you momentarily raise your level of happiness. But we're interested in long-term changes, where the baseline around which we fluctuate changes. Everyone fluctuates up and down around the baseline. Kind of the difference between weather and climate. Weather is what it is today and what it will be tomorrow and what it will be the next week or whatever. The climate is the overall. Like, for instance, let's use just one item, temperature. You know, the average temperature in, the average temperature in town A, so we don't have to pick on any town. And I can get called and told that that data is incorrect. It's not the, there's not the data I'm trying to look at. It's the concept. Let's say that in town A, the average year-round temperature is 72 degrees. That doesn't mean that it's 72 degrees every day. It will be hotter than that. It will be colder than that. It will fluctuate. Now, 10 years down the road, we look at town A again, and the average temperature may be 75. There again, that doesn't mean it's going to be 75 degrees every day. The average temperature has risen by 3 degrees. The baseline has increased. That's what we're talking about. Okay. So after 21 days, people's optimism levels were significantly higher, not a little bit. Significantly higher, because those who were classified as extreme pessimists have now moved up to the low level of optimist. That's a huge change. That's a complete paradigm shift across the line from pessimism to optimism. The optimists that were involved, remember I said that some of them were already optimists, actually improve as well. 6 months later, it was readdressed 6 months later after the experiment. After 6 months, their optimism levels were still high. They had fewer sick days and better evaluations, work evaluations. They had less depression. They had taken on more things like exercise and positive habits. Why? Because they got themselves stuck in a positive Tetris effect. Journaling for 5 minutes a day about a positive experience that has occurred over the past 24 hours with as many details as possible significantly raises not only your immune system, but also your happiness and your optimism as well. Exercise, meditation, and random acts of kindness are all positive influences on that baseline if they are routinized. Now, I can hear it. I can hear it. Somebody's out there going, well, this is all common sense. Well, yeah, duh, it is. It's all common sense. But common sense is not common action. Consider this. Doctors know more than anybody else, or better than anyone else, that exercise is important for so many reasons. But of the occupational groups within the United States, doctors are on the lower end of the groups that actually exercise. They know they should. They know all the benefits. But they're among the people who exercise the least. So how do we make the things that we know we want to do more likely? In physics, there's something called activation energy. Activation energy in physics is, in order to catalyze a reaction, there's an initial investment of energy that is required to start the formula, which is the highest amount of energy in the process. The same is true with us at the cognitive level. If you want to add a positive habit to your life, there is an initial investment of energy that is high. Now let's tie that back to the 21 days, okay? 21 days to create a positive, to create a, you know, to create a habit. So if we choose a habit to instill in ourselves, a positive habit to instill in ourselves, if we can do that for 21 days, it becomes natural. It's become routinized. But in order to do that, there's an initial investment of energy, which is very high. But if you can find a way to lower that activation energy investment, you can significantly increase your chances of doing all those things that you put as New Year's resolutions every year and give up by January 15th. Or conversely, if you want to stop a bad habit, you can raise the activation energy. Let me give you an example. Okay. Let's say you want to stop watching television so much and you want to journal more often. So you want to knock out that bad habit of watching too much TV. And you want to install that good habit of journaling, because remember we talked about it. Journaling every day, you know, 5 minutes every day, the whole immune system boost, the whole happiness and all that boost. So you want to install that journaling. Consider this scenario. You come home from work, you're tired, you're exhausted. So you plop down in the recliner or on the sofa, you grab the remote and you press the on button. That's really easy to do. Very low activation energy. But what if you take the batteries out of the remote and put them in a location about 20 seconds away? And I'll explain the 20 seconds in a minute. About 20 seconds away. Maybe you put them in a drawer in your bedroom. So that when you come home, you plop down in the recliner, you grab the remote, you press the on button, it don't work. Then you realize, oh crap, there's no batteries. The batteries are in the batteries are in the bedroom. I've got to get up and go get the batteries and put them in the remote before I can watch TV. Okay. Consider that. And then at the same time, you put your journal with a pen on the side table that's right beside wherever you plop down, within easy reach of your recliner or sofa. It used to be in the bedroom, in the drawer, in the chest of drawers or wherever. It was in the other room. Now, when you come home tired and you reach for the remote and you realize that in order to watch TV, you're going to have to go retrieve the batteries from the bedroom in order to do so, you've increased the activation energy required. Your journal is no longer in the bedroom. It's in the drawer. It's on the side table within your reach. You have lowered the activation energy for that. You are much more likely to reach for the journal and make an entry. Then you are to get up and retrieve the batteries from the bedroom in order to watch TV. I told you I'd mention that 20 seconds. I'd explain why I chose 20 seconds. Well, there seems to be a 20-second barrier in our mind. If to get to something takes less than 20 seconds, we are much higher. There's a much higher likelihood that we'll decide to commit to that and do it. If it takes 20 seconds or more, we are much higher likely to say, never mind, I'll do it later. And if you look at your life and you look at where your house is set up, you'll notice that. Say, for instance, you've got carpet and your vacuum cleaner is in the back of a closet in the kid's bedroom. When it comes time, you think about vacuuming the floor, you go, oh, okay, I want to vacuum the floor. And then you'll think, wait a minute, I got to go. You may not make this conscious train of thought, but this is what's happening. I got to go into the kid's bedroom in the back of the closet, get the vacuum cleaner out, bring it back in here. And, of course, that's going to take more than 20 seconds. So, you know, that's too much trouble. It's more trouble than it's worth. I'll get it. You know, I'll do it later. And that later very rarely comes. But let's say the vacuum cleaner is in a corner somewhere that is just around from the living room, just out of sight of the living room, because you don't want the vacuum cleaner sitting in the living room. But maybe you've got it setting somewhere where it's very easy to get to. You're much more likely that when you go, oh, I need to vacuum the floor, to go grab that vacuum cleaner, because it's less than 20 seconds to retrieve it. The activation energy is very low. 20 seconds. That seems to be the hump there. If it's 20 seconds or more, your brain will choose, I'll do it again. I'll do it later. It's too much trouble. If it's less than 20 seconds, the likelihood of you going ahead and doing it is much higher, exponentially higher. So keep that in mind. So I hope that this little discussion can help in some very small way. If anything that I have said tonight rings true, then please take it to heart. Think about it. We can engineer our own happiness. Now, I'm not telling you that you can engineer being happy all the time, but you can engineer to increase that baseline. Find what makes you feel better. Find what makes you feel worse. And work through that 21-day process to focus more on the things that make you feel better and focus less on the things that make you feel bad. By installing or removing habits that you have in your life. Install positive habits, remove the bad habits, the habits that lead to self-esteem and everything dipping. This is not a panacea. It will not be a cure-all, but it will help. It will make those good days better and more frequent. And it will make those bad days more infrequent and not quite as bad. Consider the way you look at things when bad things happen, and they will. Consider how you look at them. Remember back to my idea, my concept of Mercury retrograde. If it's a challenge, then accept it as a challenge and be thankful. Be thankful for it, because you've got the opportunity to grow. Remember those things. 21 days to routinize. Activation input, activation energy investment. If you want to get rid of the habit, increase the activation energy investment. If you want to draw the good habit in, decrease the activation energy required. Be consistent for 21 days, and you will routinize that whatever you're doing, and it will become a life habit. We can do this. You can do that for you. You can affect your world. You can increase your baseline. And remember what I always talk about, reaching that critical mass. One starfish at a time until the 100th monkey. One starfish at a time until the 100th monkey. And I want to close with this thought, this question. Are you that 100th monkey? We are evolving. And I challenge you to be involved as we evolve. I want to thank you again for joining me. And in all things, may you blessed be.
Thank you for listening to LCO on VTR. We hope you've enjoyed the show. You're invited to ladyofthecircle.org for more information about our organization. In all things, may you blessed be.